Back in 1908, oh, somebody faint. Do we have a EMT here? Right down here. That, just give him a little bit of space. This happened during my political campaign all the time.
And I think the top of our list is providing for the safety and security of the American people. That's at the top of our list.
I do not support a state income tax and never have.
The public depends on us to have a process by which we make decisions, and they expect those decisions to be made in public.
Now it's your chance to be part of the conversation. The Joe Show on AM 930, Progressive Talk, KBAI.
Welcome to Northwest Washington's only local live liberal progressive program right here on AM 930 Progressive Talk. Get all the bumper stickers in there. I'm Joe Tian, your host here each weekday, noon till 1. And we're going to talk about, well, the plight of native peoples and people concerned about exporting exporting fossil fuel from their country. And we'll touch a little bit on the coal trains, yes, but we're talking about more specifically tar sands oil and native people in Canada that are standing up against the very powerful corporate forces that want to build pipelines that will take that oil from Alberta over to the coast in BC and ship it overseas. And they've got some issues with that, just as we have issues with big corporations wanting to bring coal through our community and ship it overseas as well. And a group of, I guess I can call you young people. You're younger than I am anyway, is in town. And they're supporting these native folks up in British Columbia. They're going to be talking about what's happening this evening. There's an event at the food co-op, I believe. And we'll have more information on that and the time and everything. But joining us here in the studio are Rachel Collins and T.R. McKenzie, both members of Deep Green Resistance, a group of activists that has been touring around and talking about this issue and, well, and other environmental issues, obviously. And first of all, Rachel, T.R., welcome to the Joe Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And now you've been touring around, and Rachel, we were talking off the air a little bit. You were out on the East Coast a little bit, so this is kind of a national thing you've been doing.
Yeah, there's actually been Dylan did one of the first speaking tours for DGR, and then we had one on the East Coast. We went to a lot of cities through the South, up into, you know, the West Virginia and D.C. area, talking about the same kind of things we're talking about on this tour, but this tour is organized specifically around bringing awareness to what's going on in British Columbia and about the action camp that's going on in about a week.
Okay. So the camp hasn't started yet. Or
well,
has it?
The camp's actually been there for 3 years.
Okay.
The Unist'ot'en are a clan of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, and they put the camp at a strategic location in order to block the construction of pipelines up there that would destroy everything that they need to continue their traditional way of life. So that camp has been there for a while. This action camp is the third annual camp where they've invited non-native affinity groups to come and share strategies and stand with them in their resistance against the destruction of their way of life.
Okay, now is this in British Columbia proper, or is it where actually is the camp?
The camp is located on the Maurice River. Actually, the land that it's on is unceded territory. It's called British Columbia, but that land was never signed over in a treaty. They were never defeated in war. There's no legal or ethical precedent for it being called Canada, and the relationship between the First Nations and Canada is considered by the Native people to be nation to nation.
Hmm, interesting. And so this, I take it, is it would be a northern route. This isn't a pipeline that would come down into the Vancouver area. This would go up further north in Canada and then to the coast there, north end of British Columbia. TR?
Sure. The I believe the pipeline would go from the central part of Alberta out to the coast, out that way north of Vancouver.
And at this point, it's a proposed pipeline, or is it, as far as the developers or the builders of it, is it pretty much a done deal and these folks are just standing in the way, or where are we kind of in the process of the whole constructing the thing?
Sure. It's they call it the Trailblazer Pipeline, the Pacific Trails Pipeline. It will carry basically liquefied natural gas to the coast for exports.
Okay, and this would come from the tar sand region in Alberta.
Correct. And it's also, this isn't a proposed pipeline. This is, they actually are going to start building the right of way for the pipeline the first week of August. So basically anytime this week, they should be starting and breaking ground.
Okay. What is, and obviously with this, this encampment in the way, is there friction? Is there communication between the builders of the pipeline and the native peoples that are taking part in this protest? Or, you know, what's the relationship there?
Well, the relationship is an oppositional one. The camp was constructed for the purpose of being in the way of that pipeline. It's actually at a location that is a split-off point from the main pipeline that would split in a lot of different directions at that point and go to the coast to be exported mainly away from North America. So the camp is a blockade. That's part of the reasoning for it, is to be in opposition to the construction of the pipeline. And the organizers of the camp have said that the pipeline will only go through over their dead bodies. So us going up there is a concrete gesture of standing with them in that opposition.
How big is the camp? How many people are taking part? Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure on numbers. I think last I looked online, it should be a couple hundred at the camp. And I don't know if that includes non-native and native. I'm not really sure about exactly how many people will be there.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. You'd think that a company that's, you know, got their mindset on, you know, we're going to build this one way or another. We don't want to harm anybody if we don't have to while we're constructing it. Would they, can they potentially adjust the route of this pipeline and just skirt this camp, get around it? I mean, are there ways for that to happen, or could the camp, is it mobile enough to where it could move, you know, kind of cat and mouse, wherever they try to move the route of this, that they could jump over that spot?
Well, it hasn't generally been the policy of oil and gas companies to adjust their plans for the benefit of everyone else. Even if the pipeline itself doesn't go through this area, we're talking about poisoning the waters, we're talking about mile-wide tailing ponds, we're talking about basically every source of food, every living creature in the area being toxified and destroyed, even by indirect contact with this construction. So, I mean, the pipeline construction itself is extremely destructive. The tar sands are projected to destroy an area the size of Florida. But even if it didn't physically touch the area where these peoples are living, it would still affect them. They're still being told to not eat their native food sources and that they can't access their ways of subsistence because of the toxification due to this construction.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who has looked into the tar sands and what's really happening up there, I get a call every once in a while from a conservative here in our community who worked in the oil and gas industry for many years, says he's been up to the tar sands and that it's nothing like is described, that it's, he says it's a wonderful, wonderful place. I guaranteed them that I'd be booking my next vacation there to go and visit this Shangri-La and see just how fantastic it is. Maybe take a dip in the tailing ponds and, watch the wildlife that they have to keep out of the ponds with cannon, that sort of thing, you know, birds that keep them from landing on these ponds. But yeah, it is an environmental disaster. And you folks are going to be at, now, do you have information on what's happening this evening? I know I do, but I've got to get it out of my email here quick as to what's happening this evening at, and this is, we're inviting the community to come by and talk to you about this.
Yeah, so our event tonight will be in the Co-op Connections building, the Bellingham Food Co-op, at 6 p.m. And what we've been doing at these events is talking some about the overall goal of DGR and our overall ideas for how to halt the ecocide that we're experiencing. But as I said, specifically, this tour on the West Coast is intended to bring awareness to the action camp and to the plight of the people up there, as well as all of the non-human life that's up there, too. But also to collect donations and, you know, statements of support, you know, monetary contributions, anything that could help them to stand in the way of this construction.
As I understand, even tents, things like that, that could be used in the camp.
Yeah, we've had, you know, really an amazing outpouring of support from people on the tour so far. We've gotten tents and camping gear and food and blankets, clothes, boots, fuel, really, really anything and everything that could be helpful in a camp like this, we're really appreciating at this point.
All right, we're talking with Rachel Collins and T.R. McKenzie. They're both in town here with members. They are members, and as are others, with the Deep Green Resistance in support of the Native peoples who are camping in front of this pipeline where it's intended to go through Canada, eventually to take petroleum from the tar sands in Alberta to the West Coast where it'll be exported. And sounds like kind of a familiar scenario to us folks here in Bellingham. And we'll take a quick break. Back with more. 734-5697 is the phone number here at the Joe Show if you've got a comment or question. Back on the Joe Show here on AM 930, Progressive Talk. And we're talking about well, the environment, but also Native peoples and their resistance, their pushback against corporations in Canada that want to build a pipeline, transcontinental pipeline that would take petroleum products from the tar sands to the west coast of BC to be shipped overseas, much like the struggle that we've got here in our community. My guests here in the studio, Rachel Collins and T.R. McKenzie, both members of Deep Green Resistance, and they're here on a tour to discuss this, talk about this, publicize the struggle that these people are making. And TR, we were talking just a moment ago about how, as you've done this journey and these travels, how you communicate or want to acknowledge the Native peoples, as you know, and I'm sure you find in your travels that there are many, many different nations around the country, and we of course have Native nations right here in our own county, our own community.
Sure, it's always good when we give talks or come on the radio to show respect and acknowledge the Native peoples whose land we're on to be able to do a radio show like this. And I wanted to acknowledge the Lummi people and their way of life and the land here in Bellingham, and know that the only way that Rachel and I are able to be on your radio show today is because of an ongoing genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island, you know, for over 500 years.
Okay. Well, and we're happy to be able to have you deliver that message for sure. And this is we're talking about the coal train issue that we're dealing with here locally, and we've got Native peoples that have lined up against that type of project as well. And it goes on. You know, we think of so many of these issues. Oh, you know, it's been settled. It was settled centuries ago, generations ago, that conflict between Native peoples and basically Europeans who took over, that all this is old history, and you know, it's time to move on. But these issues still continue with the dominance of even what little land many of these Native nations have left, still being infringed upon and in many cases under attack by these kinds of things, whether it's a pipeline or other initiatives, coal trains coming through their land.
Yeah, this is still a war for many nations on this continent and others. The encroachment of Southern culture by all sorts of means. I do some work in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and it's not really disease-infected blankets or the army coming in with guns anymore that's affecting and killing their people. It has to do with alcohol and other drugs and other encroachments, mining of uranium, many other issues that they're dealing with now, but it's still killing their people and killing their culture and language.
Mm-hmm. And in many cases, that's all that's left is allowing, you know, I mean, for many of these peoples, because of the land that they've been pushed on to, maybe that's all they have is, you know, you can mine uranium. Or I remember there was a while back, there was a tribe, I believe in Utah, that was willing to accept nuclear waste as a way to generate income because they really had no other way to do it. But talking about the environment not everyone knows. I think a lot of folks are pretty well educated about the tar sands, but what they really are, and so people understand what exactly is going on up there. This isn't your typical, drill a hole and put a straw down there and take the crude oil out of the ground. And Rachel, you have some more information about what the tar sands are all about?
Well, I mean, exactly as you said, the tar sands are, I mean, they're more than just the most destructive industrial project that the history of the earth has ever seen. They're also a kind of bellwether for showing the cracks in the industrial system as it exists. So the reason that tar sands, as it's called, oil is being mined is because, like you said, when the oil boom began in Pennsylvania, you barely had to poke a hole in the ground, and they called them gushers. The crude oil would gush out of the ground like a geyser, and it took very little energy put in to get a lot of energy out. But now the tar sands are not liquid oil. They're not what people think of when they think of drilling for oil. The tar sands are what would become liquid oil were they given a few, more 100 million years left to turn into that. So what it is tar. It's mixed with sand and rock and soil and other heavy metals, and it has to be mined as a solid a lot of the time. So there's two different ways that they mine tar sands oil. The first is through strip mining. So they basically bulldoze everything and anything that exists on the land and then take out the it's called bitumen. They take it out as a solid. They have to use 5 gallons of water for every gallon of oil produced in order to wash the actual usable petroleum material out of the surrounding soil and rock.
And is it heated through a steam process? I would think they would have to be heated pretty extensively to get the oil substance out of the sand and rock.
Well, when they mine it through strip mining, they use hot water in order to do that.
Uh-huh.
But the second way that they mine it is called in situ mining, which means that they inject superheated steam in a similar process to hydraulic fracking for gas. And that, leaves some of the life in the forest on top, but crisscrossed by toxic sludge and, access roads and things like that. And once that superheated steam has heated the bitumen to a certain degree, it can be sucked out in a semi-liquid form.
Well, it's kind of telling, and I've heard it stated before, and I think quite accurately, that this is another example or another illustration of how desperate we've become to get this resource, to get our hands on petroleum, as is drilling more than a mile deep in ocean waters,
right,
to get into these we are running short on. We're getting close to being, if not at the tipping point, we're getting very close to it. And I think just your example, and I'd never heard it put that way, but that this is, I guess we could call it an immature oil deposit, one that hasn't been, covered for centuries by heavy rock formation that has turned this into more of a liquid type of a crude oil. This is like infant oil that we're after, and that I think that's kind of illustrative of where we are as a society, as a world, as far as our energy needs. And when you think about how much energy goes into producing this and how inefficient our use of our energy resources now is, I mean, it's pretty striking when how much energy we actually get out of a gallon of gasoline, for instance, compared to the actual energy that's in it. Our engines, for as much as we love them, they're not terribly efficient, even in this day and age.
Right. I mean, on top of being environmentally and ethically insane, the tar sands are also economically insane. For the amount of money and energy that's getting put in, there's not enough energy being taken out to even justify it from a capitalist point of view. So I heard the boom towns around the tar sands being compared to the Wild West in terms of alcohol and drugs, labor exploitation, prostitution. All of those things come along with the exploitation, not only of the land, but of not only the indigenous people, but people that are basically shipped in to perform this labor and then exploited and shipped back again.
What about the movement in Canada with these native people camped in front of where this pipeline is planned? Is there an environmental movement in Canada that is vocally opposing the tar sands and the further development of it, or are most of the voices down here on this side of the border?
Sure. I mean, there are radical voices willing to stand, just like our group, Deep Green Resistance, is in Canada. We're actually going to be meeting some Canadians and heading up to the action camp. It's a group called Forest Defenders. There's a couple other groups. The names aren't coming to me at this time, but a lot of problems in this country and in Canada with the environmental movement is that they're not taking the necessary steps in actually stopping these pipelines from coming through. We're really going to have to, I think, put our bodies on the line with the indigenous people to make this work, to stop these pipelines. It's not going to be, you know, going to the grocery store and buying green products. Those solution, those consumer choices will never work and they'll never save what we have left.
And a really prevalent and insufficient attitude is one of, you know, we use the term NIMBY or not in my backyard. So there's people that will oppose extraction happening in their neighborhood, but unless we're connecting that systemically to the extraction happening all over and the fact that it affects different people depending on their, you know, marginalized status or how much political power they can wield, we need to be fighting this everywhere that it exists as one cohesive problem instead of fragmenting. We're a lot less effective standing alone.
All right, we've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more. My guests, Rachel Collins and T.R. McKenzie, both members of Deep Green Resistance there in town, to highlight the efforts of Native peoples up in British Columbia to stop a pipeline, a planned pipeline, to take tar sands oil to and liquefied natural gas to the B.C. coast to be shipped overseas. And they're holding an event this evening, 6 o'clock at the Food Co-op. Is that the co-op downtown? I'll have to double check. I'll check on my.
Yeah, it's the co-op that's on the corner of Forest and Chestnut.
That's one, yeah. Downtown co-op. And, you can join them down there. You're invited once again, 6 o'clock, to talk about this issue and, make a donation if you can, a few bucks or, maybe even, some supplies that they could use if they can camp in up there. We'll take a break and be back with more here in just a moment on the Joe Show. Back in the Joe Show, AM 930, Progressive Talk. Thanks for joining us here on this Wednesday. And in the studio with me, Rachel Collins and T.R. McKenzie, two members of a group from Deep Green Resistance who are in town to highlight the plight of Native peoples who are doing their best to block a pipeline that is planned to go through their property, their land up in British Columbia, and a pipeline that would carry dirty tar sand oil and petroleum products to the West Coast to be shipped overseas. Kind of sounds like a familiar tale that we can relate to here in Bellingham. And just talking about in general, and T.R., you touched on this just before we took the break, about efforts that we need to take to stop some of these projects, if that's at all possible. And as I don't know a lot about Deep Green, but as I understand it, you folks are pretty much committed to. And T.R., you've called it a war against some of these forces, very powerful forces, big moneyed interests. And I guess what is the fundamental philosophy of your organization, Deep Green Resistance?
So Deep Green Resistance is committed to halting the murder of the planet by any means necessary, and that's going to involve every tactic that can be effective. We've seen legal techniques work, we've seen nonviolent techniques work, but we've also seen militant action work, and all of those are viable techniques for halting the destruction of pretty much everything that all of us hold dear. We all need to breathe the air, drink the water, and be able to eat the food that the land provides us, and the current structure of our society as it exists is diametrically opposed to allowing us those things. So that's the basic philosophy and the basic goal of our organization.
Well, we certainly are. Our whole process of living tips toward exploitation of the planet rather than preservation of it. But practically, I just want to pose this question to you, I guess, is you're nice young people, and you know, I've known other people that have had this this mindset that this does take radical action. And we've seen others that have taken action. I don't know how closely you may have followed, for instance, an arson down at a horticultural center down at the UW. This was a number of years ago, 10, 15 years ago, that the actual act occurred. It took a while before the people that were involved were actually caught. I believe they were members of ELF. But they were eventually tracked down and prosecuted and given substantial prison sentences. You know, we've heard of other instances where people have been, because of these kinds of actions, have been prosecuted. I mean, do you think ultimately those kinds of efforts will be productive? Will they be successful in one way or another?
Well, it's extremely important to us to note that DGR is an above-ground organization. We, as above-ground activists, restrict our activities to acting within the law, with the exception of nonviolent civil disobedience. So in terms of raising awareness, in terms of doing what we're doing, gathering supplies, all of those things are essential, and that's why we need an above ground. But those type of actions, working within the strictures of the current system alone, are not going to be enough. So calling ourselves an above ground implies that, you know, an underground will be necessary in order to accomplish halting this ecocide. So, you know, just one tactic, just one side on its own is not going to be enough. We're going to need a diversity of tactics in order to accomplish our goals.
Okay. Well, ultimately, what kind of, what kind of a planet do you envision? What, and I won't say, you know, paradise or anything like that, but ideally, what as we try to, you know, to create a mindset that that puts together, you know, we live day to day. We've got automobiles, we've got homes that we heat, most of us. We got kids in school, and these types of things. And you know, we go to the store, we buy consumer products. And but I guess in your mind, what, and either of you can answer, TR, you're grabbing the mic. What are your thoughts on what kind of what kind of a world should we, I mean, ideally in your mind, should we envision?
Sure. And I think everyone should ask themselves this question. What type of world do you want to live in? You know, I want to live, I'm from the plains, and I want to live in a world that has more wild bison every year. I want to live in a world that has more wild coyotes every year. I want to live in a world where the natural world begins to heal on its own. You know, if we just really just stop doing what we're doing, it will just heal on its own. There's nothing that we really need to actually get out with our hands and get dirty and do. The natural world will take care of herself.
Okay. As far as day to day, I mean, are we, should we just be ready to accept, not quite the lifestyle that we're used to, maybe not being as comfortable, not have as much materially as we're accustomed to?
Well, I think it becomes an interesting question of what do you consider comfortable? I was raised within civilization, grew up in the suburbs. I've, had a lot of privilege within this industrial system. And for much of my life, the height of comfort seemed to be, air conditioning in a fridge. But I think it would be very uncomfortable to not be able to drink the water and to not be able to, breathe freely. And that's not some, future dystopia. This is what's happening now. And the people that are shielded from that are, in most cases, the people that can wield the most political power, the people in the dominant classes. It's very often white people. It's very often settler culture. It's very often people that can wield economic power as well. So, industrial civilization does not make indigenous peoples comfortable. It does not make marginalized economic classes comfortable. And I think that, asking what kind of world we want to live in, I would like to live in a world where my basic daily activities don't involve death and exploitation in order to continue. I would like to be able to, take a step without crushing 200 species every day. I would like to be able to know that I live in harmony and in cooperation with the living systems around me instead of destroying them by my very existence. So I think that when we talk about our lifestyles, it gets a little bit complicated too, because yes, our lifestyles are going to have to change if we're going to live in that harmony with the natural world. But individual lifestyle choices like driving less or, turning off the lights when you brush your teeth, not leaving the fridge open, those things are, using less energy is certainly commendable. But even if everyone I know and everyone they know took every measure suggested by Al Gore, every measure that we can make without actually changing the structure, it wouldn't be enough. So power is not wielded individually. It's wielded by groups, and it's wielded collectively. And right now, the dominant classes in this country and elsewhere are wielding that power in order to marginalize others and to extract resources and to do things like that. So we really need to attack power at its source and not fight the symptoms, as many of these, piecemeal lifestyle actions have been doing.
Okay. Well, and about that conflict, and the powerful, and they are very powerful, very, you know, lots of resources, lots of money behind these companies. Just for instance, looking at the conflict in British Columbia, big pipeline, this is going to mean billions, literally billions of dollars for these entities, and they're, you know, myriad of investors, these sorts of things. So these are, you know, really powerful forces. You talk about underground groups and, you know, and in some cases, these conflicts have been to one degree or another violent with acts of arson and other things. I don't know. I think that's what, you know, a question that I think that I have and that a lot of people start to feel uncomfortable with. And, you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter, you know. I consider myself to be a pacifist. I also consider myself to be someone who is very concerned about the environment. I've got young kids, and I want the world to be a good, healthy, more healthy place for them when they get to be my age and when they have kids and that sort of thing. But, you know, I guess it's that sense of conflict that it maybe is a little off-putting or concerning. And I don't know. Do you get kind of where I'm getting at?
Sure. Let me try to answer that for you.
Sure, sure.
I'm going to take a different situation and go to a different country here. But I want to talk about Nigeria a little bit and what Shell Oil's done in Nigeria. I think the reason a lot of people in the United States have not taken the necessary actions to save our land base is because we hasn't been decimated to the point where we're starving. And in Nigeria, Shell Oil has just completely destroyed the landscape there, there was a lot of subsistence fishermen and farmers there. And when their children started starving, and they were getting sick and getting cancer from the polluted fish because of Shell Oil, and they did try nonviolent means. Ken Saro-Wiwa was executed for trying nonviolent means in Nigeria, and it just didn't work. So a group of, they say 200 or so individuals got together, and they go by the name of MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. And they've had to take militant action. They've had to kidnap people. They've had to threaten with the force of guns, ships. They've had to destroy infrastructure over there, and they've actually stopped the export power Shell Oil in Nigeria by 30%. But those people had no other choice. And we're not, I think the reason we don't take those actions is because we still have this privilege of not, of still having choices.
All right. We'll take a quick break. Back with more. We're talking with T.R. McKenzie, Rachel Collins, both members of Deep Green Resistance. Once again, they're here in town to highlight the efforts of Native peoples up in British Columbia to stop a pipeline that would carry tar sands oil through their land, and how you can help. It's a gathering today, 6 p.m. down at the food co-op downtown, and you can meet these two and the rest of their group and fine young folks, and talk to them about what their efforts, what they hope to accomplish, and the efforts of the folks that they're supporting as well up there in British Columbia. Quick break. Back with more. 734-5697. Back on the Joe Show here on AM 930 Progressive Talk. Thanks for joining us here on this Wednesday. And we're talking with Rachel Collins, T.R. McKenzie, a couple of members of Deep Green Resistance. A group of them are in town here today. An event happening this evening, 6 o'clock, down at the food co-op downtown, where you can talk to them about their efforts to help an encampment of Native peoples up in British Columbia, where they hope to block a pipeline that's planned to carry petroleum products from the tar sands all the way over to the coast of BC to be shipped overseas. And a similar issue that we're facing here with coal trains coming from a faraway place and hauling a very dirty substance to our community and then being shipped off to be burned in another country. And then we end up getting the fallout from that. We've got waters here locally that they've determined have mercury deposits that the majority of came from burning coal and fossil fuels from the other side of the ocean. It's amazing. But your calls, your questions are welcome. 734-5697. Let's go to the phones. And is it Ellen?
Yes, it is.
Hey,
hello.
Ellen, welcome to the program. Yeah, good to hear from you.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear these very, very articulate young people, passionate and articulate. Extremely. Wow. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to tell them that maybe they already know this from Max or some of the other people who are bringing them here, but I think it was about 4 years ago, a bunch of us had a campaign to get City Council to pass resolutions regarding tar sands, and they did. We did succeed. They passed two resolutions. One was, you know, I can't remember the exact wording. I have to look it up, but along the lines of not using tar sands crude in our city fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was to try to avoid tar sands crude coming through pipelines through Bellingham. They were kind of a little bit weak-kneed, but they did pass, and I worked quite closely with George Poitras at the time, the former chief of the Miccosukee Cree, who are severely affected by unusual cancers in the tar sands area. And he allowed me to read a statement from him, his own statement, to city council the night that they passed these resolutions. And the thing is, we can't stop when we achieve something like that. Otherwise, it is maybe, you know, not really that effective.
Uh-huh.
And, or maybe just dealing with symptoms, as they said. You have to keep going and use a success like that to build on. And so maybe they will re-inspire us to get that going again and do more building on what we accomplished. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for your thoughts, Ellen.
Yeah.
Yeah, great to hear from you. And thanks for your efforts on that. And I think it's a good point that she makes that, yeah, we can't rest on our laurels. And it's, in essence, what both of you are saying is, and you've made, well, more or less a career of it, it sounds like.
Yeah, thanks so much for the work you've done, Ellen. And I think that talking about legal means of resistance is really exciting to me too. I think that's something that we discount unfairly a lot of the time, talking about direct action and about militant resistance. Something that's been really interesting to us is the CELDEF model. It's the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually at work in Bellingham right now, but in many other places. And they've done things like giving rights to nature. You know, if it's written into the town or the municipality's constitution that rivers and streams and forests have rights, then I could sue a corporation on behalf of a river, and there would be a legal precedent for that. Something else that it's done is codify civil disobedience into legality in terms of enforcing those laws. So if a corporation goes against what's written in that constitution, citizens who take direct action to oppose them are protected by that legal precedent. So that's been really groundbreaking, and I'm excited to see that go forward in a bunch of different places.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've been, just as a people, as a nation, I mean, we've been willing to accept, okay, we've ignored the rights of this segment of society, of this segment. I've even known a guy who specializes in animal law, which I think is good. It's an area that we haven't recognized as being, you know, that animals themselves have rights, that just because, you know, we're so species centric in our thinking that, you know, it's not all about human beings, that if we are to survive, we're part of this ecosystem as well. And if we're to survive, it has to survive, and it has to survive in a way that is conducive to supporting life. And we'll keep working in that direction. And real quickly, we just have a couple of minutes left, but how did you two get involved in this? I mean, TR, you want to start?
Yeah. I live in southeast South Dakota, and there's not a lot of environmentalists out there. There's no Earth Firsters out there.
Mm.
We have a Sierra Club. Nature Conservancy is buying up some prairie land and restoring it, and so they're doing some good work out there. I got involved with this work by reading an author, Derek Jensen, wrote books like The Culture Make Believe and Endgame. And actually, he and Lear, Keith, and Eric McBay wrote the book that's called Deep Green Resistance. It's kind of our manual, and it's a manual for anyone that wants to defend all life on this planet. So I got involved in a reading forum of Derek Jensen's, and I met some folks that actually lived out in this area. We all just came together, and now I think Deep Green Resistance is in over 20 states, and I think we're up to over 10 countries now. So,
all right. And Rachel, you said you grew up in suburbia, kind of a middle-class kid, it sounds like. Did you have kind of an awakening?
Yep, suburban Florida. I was in Orlando going to school, and I started out in reproductive rights activism and in feminism and women's liberation, but the longer that I was teaching sex ed for a while, I was organizing around access to you know, bodily autonomy for women and access to healthcare and education. But I was seeing increasingly that education on its own wasn't working. And I was also noticing that you can't work for women's rights without incorporating anti-racism work. You can't work against anti-racism without incorporating anti-capitalism. And you can't talk about the economy without talking about the environment. So, like dominoes, I started to realize that to attack one part of the system is to implicate all of it. And luckily, as I was panicking a little bit, realizing that the activism I was doing wasn't having the effect that was necessary, my roommate was starting the DGR chapter in Orlando. So I am really lucky that I was in the right place at the right time to, you know, find others that were becoming radicalized in the same way, and it's been a really great experience.
All right. Well, thanks for coming by the Joe Show. We're out of time, but thank you, and the whole, your whole group. I know you've got a bunch that are still out in the van that are listening on the air, and welcome to Bellingham. Thanks for bringing this issue to light here in our community, and I think it helps to make us all feel connected, more connected to other folks, well, like you, like the Native peoples up there in BC who are having this struggle. As sometimes, and we've talked briefly and mentioned the issue that we're dealing with here as a community with the coal issue. And sometimes, you know, we're told these big forces out there that, you know, we can't move them. We can't adjust they're monolithic and they control everything. And it starts to make you feel a little hopeless. And I think, having folks like you come to our community and talk and communicate and tell us what you're up to, what other people are up to, I think it's a real boost. I think it's a lift to everybody's psyche and does help to keep the ball rolling, as our caller Ellen said, we need to keep doing. So thanks again for being here and coming on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
All
yeah,
right.
Thank you.
Rachel Collins, T.R. McKenzie with Deep Green Resistance. Thanks again.
And now it's time for one last cup of Joe on The Joe Show on AM 930 Progressive Talk.
Well, Chick-fil-A is in the news today as the CEO recently came out and said, yes, we support the biblical definition of marriage, and stumbled upon this little ditty that explains, well, I guess maybe about the 8 most popular definition of biblical marriage. Well, you got your man plus your brother's widow, a widow who had not born a son, is required to marry her brother-in-law if her husband is somehow killed. Man and woman, nuclear family, this is from Genesis. Wives subordinate to their husbands, interfaith marriage is forbidden. Marriage is generally arranged, not based on romantic love. Oh, and a bride who could not prove her virginity, stoned to death. Man plus wives plus concubines, that one pretty much self-explanatory. Rapist plus his victim, virgin who is raped must marry her rapist. My goodness, this is from Deuteronomy. Male soldier and prisoner of war, under Moses' command, Israelites kill every Midianite man, woman, and child, save for the virgin girls, who are taken as spoils of war. We got quite a few definitions here. This is getting interesting. Well, they got a lot going on there at headquarters at Chick-fil-A. Man and woman and woman's property. Man could acquire his wife's property, including her slaves. Well, my goodness. This marriage business is all over the map in the good book. Hope you have a great, great Wednesday. We'll be back tomorrow. Till then, good day, Northwest Washington, wherever you are.